Hello, everybody. Thanks for coming. First, I want to say that this is not going to be a demonstration. I'm instead presenting what I call footnotes to a demonstration that is happening outside, right outside the auditorium, in the foyer. Some of you might have seen it already. This is what it looks like outside, so it's these two objects. I think it's actually nice that the demonstration is outside because I always find auditoriums quite challenging in reference to action. So these are just the footnotes. So the demonstration I'm referring to is, you could see it as an encounter or a collision, maybe an accident, maybe even a dance of these two objects. These two objects have been traveling so far. They've been to Barcelona, London, the Lofoten Islands in Norway, and Minneapolis, and finally now in Berlin. The bottle changes according to different local criteria. Here in Berlin, I chose an Evian bottle. Wherever they travel, I try to engage in a local research on these two objects and their local resonances, histories, and problems. For the research on Berlin, I had help from Vera Tollmann. Thanks, Vera. So by now, the suitcase and the bottle have left quite a few traces that I'll try to recount in parts today. So not all of it, but some of the footnotes will appear. The footnotes are an attempt to create and share a subjective, and subjective here really extends to the bottle and the suitcase as well, a subjective account. I'm trying to follow the water. I'm trying to follow the plastic, the carbon, the fossil fuels, and also following travel and what it entails. It all started when I was waiting in line in Barcelona at the Barcelona airport at the check-in of a budget airline. And suddenly I noticed that everybody, including me, was holding on to the handle of a cabin-sized luggage and a plastic water bottle. Multiple questions flashed through my mind based on a sudden estrangement from this obvious and very banal situation. What forces drove us all into this line? The artists, the tourists, the business people, the NGO people, and all these other people. And how is it that we all decided to team up with the very same objects on this endeavor? And to what extent did we consciously make this decision? What does this decision implicate and express at the same time? I was reading Timothy Mitchell's Carbon Democracy at the time, and on many levels, these two objects and our bonding with them seemed a result of or an expression of or even an accelerating force in an agent in climate change, among other things. A lubricant also in the existing world order that Mitchell framed as carbon democracies. And I just want to read a quote from Carbon Democracies. Mitchell says that we always talk about oil states, and they're always the ones that are lacking democracy for whatever reason we don't really understand. And so Mitchell says that the leading industrial countries are also oil states. Without the energy they derive from oil, their current forms of political and economic life would not exist. Their citizens have developed ways of eating, traveling, housing themselves, and consuming other goods and services that require very large amounts of energy from oil and other fossil fuels. These ways of life are not sustainable, and they now face the twin crises that will end them. Although calculating reserves of fossil fuels is a political process involving rival calculative techniques, there is substantial evidence that those reserves are running out. And in the process of using them up, we have taken carbon that was previously stored underground and placed it into the atmosphere. Where this causing increases in global temperatures that may lead to catastrophic climate change. We're going to talk more about temperatures tomorrow with John Tresh. A larger limit that oil represents for democracy is that the political machinery that emerged to govern the age of fossil fuels may be incapable of addressing the events that ended, or that will end it. This is the sound that you will hear outside. So far, we had this belief that it is us who do things to things. But I'm more and more asking myself, or I feel that also a lot of other people do, that to what extent do things to us, actually? Or even more, to what extent can things do things by themselves? I find that it might require a change of language or a change of register to even start addressing this question, as it dissolves or it liquidates the distinctive ascribed roles of subject and object and who is actually in charge of things. It changes also our communications, interactions, and actually entanglement with matter. So these two things, the water bottle or the plastic bottle and the cabin-sized luggage haven't been around for a long time. Still, they are extremely successful in making us believe that they're inevitable. They're almost naturalized in the way that it's hard to imagine the world without them today. The polyethylene terephthalate, PET in short, which is more common to use, bottle, was invented by Nathaniel Converse Wyeth. He was assigned by the company DuPont. He was one of the inventors of DuPont. And he filed his patent on this bottle in 1970, and finally it was patented in 73. It also includes the machinery to produce the plastic bottle. Around the same time that Wyeth filed this patent, Phillips Petroleum started extracting oil in the oil fields of Ekofisk in Norway. And it's interesting that Phillips Petroleum merged with Conoco in 2002, which was previously acquired by DuPont in 1981. So you can see the flows of how, you know, the flow of crude oil is secured to feed into all these different patents that DuPont, as one of the major companies producing plastic and having all these patents on it, to have the source material in its own hands in production and also extracting. This is a drawing by my fictional assistant, Seda Nayumat. For some reason, she started drawing or painting all the oil rigs of Norway. I don't know why, but this is one of her drawings. So the suitcase, the cabin luggage suitcase, the one that we know now, you know, with the wheels and the handle, it was invented by a pilot of Northwest Airlines only in 1989, so that's really not very long ago. And he also filed a patent, which he received in 1991, as you can see here. That's part of an extract of his patent. So the interesting thing about, or what strikes me about these two objects is that they haven't been around very long, but they have a very powerful agency, it seems, in, you know, shaping our lives or being part of our lives, and it's almost difficult to imagine what was before them. In the case of the water bottle, of course, before there were public fountains, you know, people used public fountains in all major cities to get their water, even their drinking water, which we now believe is, you know, you can't drink this water. This is an image from the first station of the suitcase and the water bottle. This is from Barcelona, a photograph by David Seymour from 1938, where Barcelona was under siege during the Spanish Civil War. And the anarchists had collectivized the Sociedad de Aguas de Barcelona, the water distribution company. And so water had become a common commodity. Here in this picture, you see a citizen stocking up on water in Gran Via, which had just been hit by a bomb the day before. Berlin also has a story of privatization of water. It's a bit different, but it's also interesting. Here you see the former mayor of Berlin, Diepgen, signing the contracts with two companies, Vivendi, which is now Veolia, and RWE, to privatize Berlin's water distribution company. So they sold 49.9% to these private companies, and 50.1% stayed, with in the communal ownership. This was in the dawn of the Berlin bank scandal, which, you know, turned out as, it was revealed a year later, but of course people, insiders like Eberhard Diepgen, they already knew about the big gaps in Berlin's in Berlin's householding. So they sold it for 3.3 billion, sorry, Deutschmarks at the time. Oh no, it was, sorry, I'm mixing it up. It 3.3 billion euros. The contracts were quite dubious, but there was a successful campaign, and then finally a referendum by initiative called Berliner Wassertisch to recommunalize Berlin's water, and it was successful. So there was this referendum where Berlin's citizens voted to recommunalize the water. I think this is something that is happening in a lot of places at the moment, also being discussed in a lot of places. So finally, last year in December, the Berlin water was bought back from these two companies. And the city had to take out a loan to do this. So they have to pay a lot of money to the banks to pay back these loans. It's the only thing that I found is the contract. There's no photo because I think it was, for the politicians, it was not as a glamorous event as the privatization. Another thing that is quite significant in Germany in general, and also in Berlin, is that Germany for a long time has a multi-way system to, for bottles. You reuse the bottles, and there's this thing called Pfandsystem, which means that you that you pay a deposit, which you get back when you bring the bottle back. In 2003, when the Green Party was in power, they introduced a compulsory deposit for one-way drink packaging. So any drink that was in a bottle that was, you know, not reusable had also a deposit on it. This resulted, of course, in a lot of recycling, and recycling became a major industry. So there's a lot of different products being made from these recycled bottles, these recycled one-way bottles. And here you see, for example, Veolia, the very same company that had bought the water, they're also into recycling. But it also had other effects because it coincided with a very neoliberal invention of German politics called Hartz IV. So at the very same time that the compulsory deposit for one-way drink packaging was introduced, also Hartz IV was introduced as bringing together unemployment benefits or unemployment money and social welfare into a subsistence minimum that was then paid to people and created a precarious class in Germany. So basically a new activity or a new way to get to money was to collect these bottles, and this is a very Berlin phenomenon. You see people collecting bottles everywhere. In the aftermath of the Berlin bank scandal, which left the city basically bankrupt, the city was declared as poor but sexy, conveniently. Due to the deregulation of air traffic in Europe in 1993, an increasing number of tourists was brought into Berlin, but also into other major cities. The discussions in Barcelona around the effects of tourism were quite similar to what the discussions are here in Berlin. But what is interesting again in terms of, you know, things happening at the same time is that in 1993, the same year, the unconditional right to asylum in Germany, which was in the, you know, in the constitution, in the German constitution, part of the German constitution, was revoked, and it was basically turned into a law with I think 200 paragraphs, and it made it extremely challenging, if not impossible, to apply for asylum in Germany. But maybe it's good to go back a bit further with, you know, German politics around migration. I forgot to mention this, and this is interesting in terms of a deregulation of air traffic and tourism. These are two maps of EasyJet as one of the budget airlines. What I like about them is that they actually look like fountains. It's kind of like the replacement of public fountains with budget airlining. Germany has a very specific history of guest worker contracts. They signed the first guest worker contract in 1955 with Italy, and then soon after followed Greece, Turkey, and many other countries. And what Germany had expected, here you see some people arriving from Spain and Portugal to work at Siemens in Germany. And what Germany had envisioned was that they would just come and work and then they would go back home, you know, almost in this kind of tourist principle. And it was also reflected in the way that people were accommodated. So, you know, they were put in places where it's almost like a youth hostel type situation or like a camp situation. And so in 1973, Germany, when they kind of figured out that this was not the way they expected, you know, that people actually claimed a life in Germany, that they didn't want to just go back home and pack their suitcases and go. And there was a recruitment ban, which is still in place in most parts today. During that time, asylum started to also have an increasing relevance. And as I said before, it was then kind of revoked in 1993. It was even made more complicated due to Dublin regulations introduced in 2003, where people who arrive in Europe, they have to go back to the country that they first put their foot on European ground. So if they arrived in Italy or in Greece, they have to apply for asylum there. So if you look at the map, it's very, very difficult to apply for asylum in Germany based on this law, because it has no shores. 2003, the Dublin regulations were installed, and it's the same year of Hartz IV and also of the compulsory deposit of the one-way drinking packaging. Since 2012, there is a powerful movement that exists all over Europe, but in Berlin, it existed as a camp on Oranienplatz by refugees who are striking, who are protesting the laws in Germany, how asylum is basically in existence and how asylum seekers are treated in Germany. This very powerful movement is treated with a lot of ignorance by the politicians, but also with a lot of support and solidarity by Berliners, by people who live in Berlin, and this is very significant. So this tent city that existed in Oranienplatz since 2012 was evicted this year in a very very kind of clever divide and conquer move of the Senate and the politicians involved by just talking to one group of newly arrived refugees to take down the tent and being promised that their cases would be reviewed, which was a scam, which turned out later not to be true because they all, you know, got letters that they had to go back to Italy, where they first arrived. So the newest development, or one of the newer developments in this, was that some of the activists in refugee strike movement who got this letter that that they basically had to leave the country, they occupied the roof of a hostel where they had been accommodated after the camp and the school where they had been living, the former school, had been evicted. So this is where a lot of things come together in my mind, because it's quite telling that that the city put these refugee strike activists into a youth hostel, into a, not a youth hostel, a hostel like these cheap hotels, budget hotels, and the protest was very significant. In this image, you see a team of doctors who are trying to bring water to the people on the roof, and the police, in their tactics, did not allow the team of doctors to go in and basically said that if they want water, they need to come down. And I think this is a very significant tactics of you know, it has been applied already before, and I think it's quite amazing that you would deny someone the right to water. I mean, you would think that this is a basic right, but as we've also seen in Detroit, maybe you know, this is a real struggle because it's actually possible to deny someone the right to water. You know, just as a kind of contrast to this, this is the Berlin Marathon, one of the very successful touristic events in Berlin, and it's sponsored by the Berlin Water Distribution Company, who gives out free water to everyone who participates in the marathon. You have also Veolia, the private company. This is just down here at the HKW this week, where they sponsored this sports event happening on the canal, on the river. So I want to end with the image of the refugee strike in on the roof of the hostel. And this is the end of my presentation. It's not the end of this journey, because I think that there's a lot more to explore in here and to ask. So thank you very much.